In this episode, we're going to talk to Prairie Spirit School Division to find out more about the challenges and impacts of being connected and how the school division took the lead in ensuring that both schools and students across the region were able to get online.
Keith Maria, I've worked at the division level in school divisions across southern Manitoba, including Southwest Horizon, Prairie Spirit, where I worked with Troy, and then Pine Creek.
I'm Troy Sigvaldason, current IT director for Prairie Spirit School Division. I've been there for about 15 years, and then current year president for MATEL. So Manitoba Association of Education Technology Leaders, as well as the mayor of my hometown, Balder, located in Argyle. So I have a few hats that I flip between as needed.
Okay. If I can just get you to basically start with kind of describing what the problem was, kind of situate the division in the province and the local areas, so listeners will get an idea of that. And then just what was the problem? What were the things that were what were your options? What had you tried in the past?
I can go back a little farther in time, and then Troy can jump in on his as well. I started off in Southwest Manitoba with Southwest Horizon School Division. And at that time, because of the sparsity of the school division and the size of the schools, we were struggling to be able to offer high school programming to our students. To the point that around in the early 90s, there was a Industry Canada grant came through along with province that allowed us to build our own microwave towers that connected schools in order to provide interactive instructional television, ITV. That was between seven communities in Southwest Manitoba. The system was buggy. It was frustrating to use. And the hardware we were using at each end was extremely expensive to the point of being gouged. There's only two companies at the time were offering equipment, and we were paying full commercial rates for studio level equipment that was far in excess of what we actually needed, but we had no other choice in the matter. So at that time, it was for the school divisions, it was a fairly good deal. We were paying $0.30 on equipment and installation, and we ended up with some pretty amazing infrastructure in terms of the towers that are still in rural Manitoba to this date being used for internet or wireless. Then in the late 90s, we started with email in the school divisions. And at that time, we discovered that we did not have the bandwidth to allow our staff to communicate between sites. Frustration with that was both Manitoba Hydro and Manitoba Telephone have fiber already trenched into our communities, in many cases across the street from our schools. And we were not allowed to tap into it as a resource. And so we had to rely on copper lines from Manitoba Telephone at 2 and 3 meg service levels that as soon as we started to embrace the internet more around 2000, we completely outmatched what was able to be provided to us. That frustration continued for several years. I would say up until even 2015, we're dealing with that. And that's probably where Troy can jump in. He has more of the knowledge of what we were actually installing at that time. Troy and I worked together on several contracts to try to increase service levels to schools. At that time, I was with Prairie Spirit School Division. And we managed over the years to have, through several different systems, some very good service to our students and to our staff. Troy, do you want to take from there?
Yeah, no, wholeheartedly agree. And Prairie Spirit, not that much dissimilar from Southwest Horizon for kind of that context of the history of connectivity and particularly leveraging the IITV programs or distance ed programs. I'm a product of those programs. So late 90s, I graduated in 2000. So I was sitting in a classroom with these programs. I believe at one point Prairie Spirit was like in the top 5 broadcasting networks in Manitoba, just given our size and the amount of buildings that were connected. It was a closed caption system. It was effectively, they had at that time used surveillance equipment and then were able to get it to route through a network and just be point to point while connecting multiple sites. So kind of neat to see, right? And you know, 18-year-old me would have never told you that this many years later I was the guy sitting there trying to help design it after being a product of it. But and that's where, you know, the fun was. I got to know Keith in you know, early 2010s ish, something along those lines. And we were kind of sitting there. We had fiber in Prairie Spirit, but we had one connection in Holland, Manitoba, at 100 meg symmetric, and it was feeding into our wide area network that consisted of multiple towers, radios, equipment that way, all done in-house, all done by levying the local tax base and using education dollars. And we were sharing that 100 meg connection, which was an incredible step forward compared to the copper lines like Keith was talking about, across 14 schools. And it didn't take long, again, where we had outgrown everything that was in front of us. So in 2014, Keith and I paired up. We realized we absolutely knew we had to find something bigger, better, faster. Put out an RFP, and there was multiple proposals come forward. At that time, NetSet Communications was one of the bidders, and they had put forward a complete wireless revamp of our network. So being in that wireless world, having the towers, there's a multitude of factors that come into play with what can haunt you, let alone just running out of bandwidth. A power outage 50 miles away knocks your network out. You know, a heavy rainstorm knocks your network out. There's so many things. So what Keith, and he definitely mentored me in this, which was kind of fun. What the idea was to build redundancy and resiliency into what we already had. So we gave a dedicated amount of bandwidth to each site instead of trying to share a pool. And we built, in conjunction with NetSet, what was called a ring network at the time, which allowed for multiple paths of receive and transmit. So if one link failed, broke, whatever happened, we still had connectivity into that school. And that was in 2014. Project kicked off in the summer of 2014, 2015. We had it live, brand new day. It was a 10-year agreement. We are still, in effect, in that agreement right now, albeit that I have issued RFPs and that we do have other plans kind of on the horizon come July 2025. But you know, looking back on that all now, right, Keith, like if you'd have told me 10 years ago that we were going to have a handful of ISPs trenching fiber through our division, and our division is large, it's 70 miles by 70 miles, I'd have laughed. Yeah, I'd have said no way. But here we are. So the growth that we have seen, you know, I have seen in my career on this, and that kind of goes all the way back to me sitting in that high school classroom taking in some of the programming, is been fantastic. Would I say it feels delayed? Absolutely. Could have used that a long time ago, but it feels like the infrastructure is kind of there for us to leverage. We're not breaking the bank to do this anymore. This isn't seven-figure investments anymore. It's much more or less, and we're very much able to leverage the investment that municipalities have made, that our local Hutterian colonies have made, with the infrastructure that they have laid and the partnerships that they have made, and it's been fantastic, and you know, growth and bigger, better, faster on the horizon.
Okay, excellent. So it sounds there's been quite a significant change in the options available to you in this time. What's behind that? What has changed that's allowed this kind of development in these areas? We've talked, you know, for years about the digital divide and the lack of investment in rural communities, but if you're noticing that is changing, what's behind that?
Myself, I believe, I mean, the pandemic really changed things, changed how everybody looked at things, and it opened up some models and some funding that wasn't necessarily always available to us. I think it kind of, that was the straw that broke that camel's back, where everybody realized, oh man, we need to be able to provide these options in these areas. With private investment only, the math on us didn't make any sense. Your recovery of investment wasn't there. And for them to invest in that infrastructure, I mean, it would have been 50 years before they finally saw a turn, right? So seeing that and seeing multiple carriers being able to do it to create competition has been fantastic. And that's really what it is most communities in our area now. It's not a single ISP that's coming. It's multiple. And there's more coming. They're definitely still growing. They've seen that there's absolutely a market for it here. And that turn has happened, but, not saying that we didn't have absolutely anything in the past. I mean, wireless was pretty much the only go-to. You had the copper side. Most of those organizations were making investments to do any upgrades. I'll give NetSet, iNetLink, NetSet Explorer, Net Explorer. You know, they were the ones that, you know, actually kind of felt like they were providing a little bit of growth, and whatnot. But just too many factors in the wireless world, unsatisfied customers, I think, led to everybody really, really trying to drive towards what's the more sustainable, reliable connection. And that's where not only did, you know, the economic development side of the communities, the municipalities and the school divisions kind of all come together as one, but it provided that foundation for everybody to kind of start talking about the same thing. And it has led to these projects today where yeah, we've got significant investment coming through these communities.
I can pick up there a bit of what Troy is mentioning is that I think what drove this, Joel, was we had a very clearly definable need that we had to meet. We are fortunate to have a board of trustees that understood it as well and would be able to support this plan. And as we drove forward, we had the need, we also had the capacity within our school division to design, because of Troy and his team, we could design and meet this need. It actually was a demonstration to our communities of what could be. The school division was ahead of all of our communities in terms of their infrastructure and their capability. Likewise, and I don't think this is a kind of a chicken or egg thing, is that we were also, in terms of technology, we were very ahead of our pedagogy in how to use this to teach effectively our students. And that's still playing a lot of catch up. I think it always will. But for some reason, our technology was able to outpace our pedagogy on about the last 30 years on this.
Excellent.
And all this was with, I'd say, since that infrastructure grant in the mid-90s, this has been totally without any support from either the feds or the province. Not only a lack of support, but a total lack of interest.
Right.
Regardless of political party.
But you're saying in the absence of that kind of federal or provincial kind of leadership or anything like that, the community just got to a point where it had a specific need and it looked at what it had for options and resources and just decided to serve itself?
Correct.
Excellent. I mean, that is something that we've heard before. I'm interested in, and I look at it in a cycle of kind of deployment, adoption, and then like support. So we've talked about deployment a little bit. So as far as the actual physical infrastructure, the technology has improved, your options have improved. Have you seen that adoption? Like you talked about the pedagogy a little bit. Have you seen the adoption increase with that in the school and then also in the community in general? Is the adoption starting to happen? It tends to be that when you don't have the infrastructure to rely on, you don't have the users that trust it. But if the infrastructure is improved, are you seeing that next level of adoption in the school, in the community?
I think, you know, particular Troy mentioned about the pandemic, it forced us to. There was no choice. We had to make sure that every student, almost from grade 1 to grade 12, had a device in their hands so that they could either work at school or at home. Our weakness was many of our homes did not have internet connections or did not have a high enough quality of internet connection for the students to participate, which really led to, you mentioned before, about the digital divide that's still there, not just between families, but between communities as well. We have communities in Manitoba that still are relying on either wireless through one of the ISPs, they're very poor quality, or some of them are still picking up from MTS, they're picking up through copper lines.
Yeah, and that adoption piece, like Keith alluded to it earlier, the technology and the pedagogy and the operational side of everything has always outpaced what the infrastructure around us has been. The adoption was already there. It was more trying to pave that highway to drive the car down. When the speed limit was only 50, they could only do so much. I'll give teachers all the credit in the world. They have learned how to manage their time, manage access, share access, all that kind of stuff. And fortunately, I mean, when we stepped into the pandemic, our tech at that time, we were leaps and bounds ahead of a good chunk of the world, to the point where Maggie McIntosh had written an article about us in the Free Press dubbing us pandemic proof, which we had everything. But as again, Keith alluded to, you can send the shiniest, you know, most educationally focused and specific device that's going to do the task with the technologies that the students need to learn. But if they didn't have a good connection at home, it was kind of all for naught in the end. So everybody learned. I mean, everybody was able to work around it. Households, they kind of scheduled the timetable themselves, right? If you had a couple kids in the house and you were on a DSL connection, well, only one kid was going to be on class at a time, and so on. But when it comes again to that adoption portion, it'll be really nice to see that infrastructure can surpass the technology in the classroom, because the adoption will never be a problem. The pedagogy is there. The systems are in place to implement this technology in incredibly meaningful ways. And it's only going to continue to grow, and opportunities are only going to be created from everything that's about to come. So.
It's very much a pre-pandemic strategy that we had in communities like this, was to put your eggs into one basket. There was larger connections at the school or at the library, or there were community centers that had, computer labs or whatever. But then that was almost a bigger problem, because people relied on those to use, because they didn't have the connection at home.
Absolutely. We were firing up wireless networks in the parking lots of all our schools during that time, right, to allow students to be able to come and connect. And they would sit just like I am right now, and in a vehicle, and pull up their assignments, download everything that they need, and take off and go do their work. So, everybody got creative.
It's an interesting argument maybe to make that we haven't had to wrestle with in the past, that the home, the house where there is a student in it, is arguably an extension of the school, right? Now that, exactly. that connectivity, yeah, at the school, so I ask these questions to myself, why aren't there packages where, if you're a student, you get a cheaper rate or things like this? I mean, in the days of the textbook, when you took science, you were given the textbook and you took it home and you did your homework and you brought it back. You were given the tools that you needed to do the learning. And if now those tools happen to be digital, they still need a connection, right? So there's some rethinking, I think, at a lot of levels as far as how we treat that connectivity and what it's for. And it did grow up, I think, as along the entertainment lines. So we used to treat it like a luxury, like for entertainment purposes. But it's changed so fundamentally that I think we kind of need to rethink it, which is why these conversations are so important. Appreciate it. The third part then, and this is I'm interested in, especially in a rural and remote area, is the technical support for this. So, as much as we build this stuff and it just magically works, it doesn't just magically work, right? For anybody on the technical side, they know how much goes into keeping things going. And then obviously it's a never ending cycle. It's an insatiable demand. There's always going to be need for more. There's always going to need to upgrade equipment and cybersecurity, all those types of things. So that's tough enough to do in an urban center. How do you deal with the technical support side and developing the workforce and all of that in a rural context?
I mean, ultimately, we're incredibly fortunate. Right? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we're incredibly fortunate in Prairie Square. We have a great team, and everybody's kind of there. You see the idea behind what the work is, the payoff in that classroom, that it's that goal, it's that fire that keeps you going on this stuff. And we're fortunate enough to have the team to be able to do it and be able to meaningfully do it and partner in right ways I think anybody and everybody will agree funding will always be the biggest challenge for technology and education. Most of the times we're funded with contingency budget lines, you know, a budget line that's got an under budget remaining on it gets kind of fed to us, and we're like, okay, hey, we can do this giant, incredibly important project now because of that meaning. And that's something that we're trying to work on changing. We're trying to work with the existing government right now on redoing how technology is approached and funded, providing support to the support as well from the top down. And that's MADL's role. And that's been my big piece in that is ensuring that best practice is there. You know, everybody needs to advocate at the grassroots level for the funding to be able to pull off these projects and ensure that best practice and policy is in place and followed and accessible. And we need to give them the tools to be able to do that as well. So like you said, infrastructure comes to demand. It's this insatiable thing where it's going to continue to grow. And with that, the support needs to grow as well. Without it, it's, you know, it's going down that highway with flat tires on that car, metaphorically, right? So the hope is it's going to grow. I think there's promise on this. Current work is already kind of underway on this through MADL and working with the department and the current government. So I think we're going to see some promise and some change in this, and hopefully allow that cart to catch up to the horse, because it's lagging behind right now.
One other type of resource we can add on top of that is switching from Prairie Spirit, which just has a very successful track record. As I moved on from there to Pine Creek School Division, which would be Austin, McGregor, Gladstone, and then going north from there. They had in the town of Gladstone, they had 10 make connections to each of their two schools there. That was it. That was up until 2022. We did finally get Westman Communications to trench in there. And so they're connected now. And that was working with the Ontarian Broadband Network, HBNI. But the interesting ones were Langruth and Plumas, which none of the ISPs had any interest in servicing. They just too many miles to trench. The ISPs in the province that did get federal money to support that, they, in my mind, misappropriated the money and used it to overbuild in southern communities that already had internet and fiber. So that money was taken from the taxpayers and misused. And again, that's my opinion. But we had to actually put in Elon Musk's, what's it called, Troy? It's not Skynet, Starlink?
Starlink. Yeah.
We had to put a Starlink satellite on those two schools. And then thanks to Merlin in Winnipeg with Kylie Bender, we were actually able to integrate that back into our system in a secure and appropriate manner. So in terms of tech support, we relied incredibly heavily on Merlin to help us with that. I think it was only about 5 years ago the province was trying to kill Merlin. And again, MADL and a few of the other organizations and many of the rural school divisions said, like, this is an essential service for us that we count on. And thank goodness they left it in place. And it's just an essential part of that tech support for our schools.
Hello. Thanks for listening. We just heard from Troy Sigvaldson and Keith Murray. And in the next half of the episode, we will hear from Jill Monjan and Cheryl Monjan to learn more about Prairie Spirit School Division's journey to connectivity.
Yeah, we usually ask by starting, like, what was the problem you were trying to solve? What were your options? Kind of take us back to that point, and then we'll just kind of work our way through. So then, you know, what were your considerations? What did you do about it? Where are you now? Kind of thing. So what kicked this off? What was the problem, and what were your options that made you take action?
Is there a time period that you're looking for? Like, there were, you know, how far back? How many problems do you want to hear?
That is a good question. I guess, you know, just to keep it, I find that the pandemic, like the 2020, is kind of a significant timeline. So maybe, you know, not farther back than like the 2018-ish kind of time frame, okay. Maybe. Just because that was such a different time frame. I know that in education as well, that the lockdowns was a really big kick change in, you know, right things. So maybe a tiny bit before and then through the pandemic and then and where we're at now would be a good time frame.
Okay, sure.
Cheryl, do you want me to start with what I know about Keith's work before you start at the office here?
Yes, please.
And then you can chime in on your perspective. So I was working in the division office in 2019-2020. I can't really recall how the idea originated, if there was fiber going into other areas in Manitoba or connections that the superintendent had or news information about fiber progressing through rural Manitoba. And Keith at that time saw that there really wasn't any infrastructure in the area to allow for fiber to be possible for schools in a subsequent, you know, contract. Because at the time we were under a 10-year contract with formerly NetSet, and now that's Explore. But he definitely didn't, I think, was looking at it as not wanting the communities to miss the opportunity to be part of the fiber rollout that was maybe happening in other pockets of the province. So my recollection of it was that within our division, we have 14 different municipalities. A few of those municipalities, we just have very small amount of property that fall into Prairie Spirit, but I'd say about 10 RMs, we have the entire RM, Argyle being one of them. And because of the former superintendent, Keith Murray's expertise in tech, he saw that there really wasn't much information that the RMs in his perspective were aware of or had the skill set to start a conversation about bringing fiber to the communities. So at the time, he spearheaded a call for proposals with internet service providers that were either well established into fiber or getting into fiber, different technologies. And he invited all the RNs to come and listen to those proposals. So it wasn't necessarily at the time that the school division could participate because we were already under contract, but more about helping the communities increase their options or awareness of what those options were. And so I think that happened in January, February, 2020.
Okay, cool. And were there options? Like, was this a number of ISPs who responded to this? One or two?
Yeah, there was a number of ISPs that responded. And then we had really good turnout from RM counselors, CAOs who came to our board office, which is kind of central to the region, to hear what those were and likely report back to their councils on, you know, what they heard and whether they wanted to do next steps. I think later that spring, I was more disconnected from it because the superintendent retired in February 2020, conveniently right before COVID hit. But I do believe he did some contract work or advised on, you know, tendering out those at an RM level. But the school division wasn't really involved in that process.
Okay.
And so my entire experience, 2018, 2019 was at the school level, working in a school, in a high school, grade 9 to 12 in Prairie Mountain High School, where we did have students taking some blended learning courses. We were fortunate that Swan Lake and Somerset had reconfigured in 2013, and we were able to minimize the number of blended learning courses that we had students taking, because even though our blended learning capacity had really improved since the early days, it was still desirable to have a teacher live teacher in the building in front of students. And that was certainly preferable for students and their families. And we heard that loud and clear. As the principal who's also teaching, connectivity was critical for us as we tried to move towards, a 2-to-1 and a 1-to-1 situation with devices and students. Certainly it allowed us to, continue work with students on intermittent storm days. We could still post on Google Classroom, we could upload videos. There was a lot of work that we were able to continue even when students weren't physically in front of us. About that time, I also traveled with a group of students on an international exchange and was able to upload all of my math classes over the course of 7 days with very little interruption to the classes. Boatload of marking when I got back. But certainly there was a continuation of a regular math class where finding someone to replace me that had a comfort level with math would have been very challenging. And it's gotten even worse in 2024. So that connection that's being able to maintain with students was really important then. And it's more important now for sure. Certainly my personal experience in Somerset, where I also live at the time, was, pretty frustrating pre-fiber. And I think it's probably 2 years that we've been connected to fiber in the town of Somerset itself. And it's been life-changing in terms of the fact that it's a non-issue for us now. It's never down. It's not slow. It's just a non-issue. It's like this whole thing that used to irritate us, this irritant, is completely vanished. I wish I could say that it's vanished from schools, but it hasn't yet. As we move towards fiber connectivity in schools, we hope that we are able to minimize the challenges that we have continued to experience with our blended learning and, all the expectations that staff now have in 2024 with being able to connect to colleagues and students.
Okay. Excellent. So then, I mean, that's a fairly common problem. You kind of hit on things. You also hit on it. It's interesting. I've heard it a few times now. And we've changed the way we asked the question, I think, because of kind of what you're saying. We were saying like, oh, what do you do now that you didn't do before? Like, what amazing innovative thing do you do now? And the answer is more like, I just do the normal stuff and I don't, throw a shoe, every 5 minutes kind of thing, because I'm so mad. It's just basic stuff. I just use it like any normal person uses it. I just don't have to like take turns using it, or like all these things that we think are just kind of average normal days. It just is just removed all those. And you kind of said the same thing, which is, it really is repositioned kind of my thinking anyway about that interaction with that technology. Not having to think about it is something that I think that a lot of people just take for granted, right? So so not all of your schools are fiber yet?
Correct.
Okay. And is that actively changing?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So the board put out a request for proposals in the spring for the July 1st, 2025 date, because that is when our existing contract expires. And they heard from vendors and reviewed pricing, and they have approved agreements with fiber connectivity to all of our schools, except I think maybe 2 colonies, Cheryl.
Yes.
That would have fiber beginning on July 1st, 2025.
Okay. And then how was that experience? So this is often, and it sounds like this is going to be true for you as well, this is a learning experience. Nobody necessarily had these experience or skills when starting it. Everybody just kind of dove into the deep end and figured it out. So how was that process in each of these projects around the province? We're dealing with different things. Some are taking it on themselves and doing it. Some are contracting it. Some a little bit of both. So yours is the contracting journey. What was that like? What skills did you need to develop, or relationships did you have to build, that kind of a experience? Because let me just quickly sidebar. what we're trying to pull out of these kind of discussions too are the barriers that you faced, so that we can find common barriers across the province, and you know, just tips about what you needed to succeed. So what are the things that you needed to develop, and what are the barriers that you experienced? And we're seeing commonality across these projects. So that's kind of our goal. So what was your journey, and what were the bumps along the way, and how did you deal with that? It's a big question, sir.
You know what? I'm sure Jill will have a more detailed and technical answer. I would say that not just in this experience, but in many experiences since I've moved into the superintendency in 2020, I'm often disappointed and usually frustrated with outside service providers. And when we lose control over the ability to fix or improve a service, we can be dissatisfied with the speed with which, or the urgency with which, our needs are being addressed. And, you know, that's everything from, you know, when we're, you know, leasing photocopiers to, you know, anything, right? In terms of technology as well, that's certainly the case. We don't necessarily have the capacity to provide all of the services that we need for Prairie Spirit School Division. And we enter into contracts with outside agencies who then are purchased out. They're bought out by another agency. You know, our representative quits and we get a new representative. Suddenly they go from having a home base in Brandon, which is, you know, 45 minutes away from our closest school to Brandon, to being centralized in a different province. And they don't know where Prairie Spirit is. And then there, you know, we are very far down the list of priorities for servicing. And meanwhile, students in classrooms are suffering, teachers are frustrated, and our computer techs feel incompetent, even though it really has nothing to do with them or their assignment. And so that's always very frustrating. And it's difficult to trust that it isn't going to continue to occur, because it, even when we have, you know, someone who seems more local as a representative, that relationship is only as stable as their willingness to remain in the position, or as, you know, as willing as the company is to remain committed to having a representative close to Prairie Spirit assigned to Prairie Spirit, and they aren't doubling their service area. And so, you know, I do, we always ask the question anytime we do anything in Prairie Spirit, do we have the capacity to handle this ourselves? And what are the advantages to, you know, hiring a person and developing their skills and doing it ourselves? It's a challenging workforce right now. So, you know, we consider those questions carefully, but I have lowered the bar on my expectations for what kind of services we can expect in the long term when we count on outside agencies, you know, and I'm disappointed to say that, but you know, that has been something that's been fairly common for us across many outlets.
Okay. That's perfect. Yeah. High standards and low expectations. it's a good way to go. No, that's very good. I mean, we have had these conversations, and it's a trade-off, right? You know, the more you do yourself, the more control you have. But that comes at many costs of those things, the physical, monetary cost and supporting this person. And then if they leave, you've got another person. We'll circle back later, but I do have some kind of workforce questions later. But those are all very excellent points. And then, yeah, the trade-off is it's just a bill, an invoice on the line item. But yeah, you don't have any control over where you are in the priority list. Okay, excellent points. Jill, do you have any?
I can think of, I agree with exactly what Cheryl said, but a couple other barriers. I think could connect to funding. So if you look up the funding of schools for the province of Manitoba, we're funded at $62 per FTE for technology. And so when you think about like getting internet in, the software, the hardware, the security, all the things you need, the funding just isn't there to be able to facilitate everything we want to do and need to do for our students and our staff. And then the other piece is when you're going through these RFPs, And your rural division, we do not have procurement specialists on speed dial to help us with all the nuances of the RFP and tender process and making sure that the contract is going to result in the best service for the duration of the period, like Cheryl alluded to. And so I think those are barriers where we don't necessarily have specialists in that. We really, in our division, are really fortunate to have our IT director who has a lot of great connections, has a lot of knowledge, does a lot of investigating, and spends tons of time to ensure that we're getting set up the way we should or what other options are that we should consider. So we're really fortunate in that lens. And I think that really helped us get through the RFPs and get through the challenges with service providers that we've had.
Okay, excellent. I assume that, two questions. Is the funding formula that you mentioned, is that prorated across, does it take into consideration the cost of business in across divisions, or is that just a flat rate across the
Flat
province for
rate. And so
Okay.
our board has been very supportive, like Cheryl mentioned, because we've had to rely on blended learning to facilitate our small schools who require, you know, the specialists at the high school level. They have, since the early 90s, put in money into the special levy through their ability to tax the local ratepayer, put in funding through that mechanism for internet connectivity. But, you know, as internet connectivity evolves, you continue to have those costs, right? And updates and improvements to make, which make it a heavy burden on the taxpayer because the funding model doesn't recognize the full technology load that is required in education.
Right, and that it costs more to do something in a smaller location, which kind of leads me to my second question. I assume that there must be additional costs because you're going to the provider as a small entity as opposed to like a whole region. You know, like your negotiating power as a smaller entity is must have some factor when you're negotiating RFPs and things like this. Is that reasonable?
I would say yes. You know, that's the piece that they don't really tell us, the rates they're giving to other divisions that may be larger. But I would say that that would be true. Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us. Please tune in next time for another episode of Connected MB.